Tonight we're going to talk about the image of God in us, in human beings. We're going to talk about power. We're going to talk about human rights and why they might be important to Christians and to humanity. Last week, Matt looked at Genesis and how God created humans in God's image. I was going to look at the image passages in the New Testament, but as I was thinking during the week, I got stuck back in the Old Testament. So maybe we'll be able to, in a few weeks' time, in the subsequent ones, we'll be able to move it on a bit further. But I want to read the story of Naboth's vineyard. Has anyone heard that story before? About Naboth and his vineyard? No?
Well, the name doesn't ring a bell. There are lots of vineyards in the Bible.
This is a really exciting story. It's full of political intrigue. It could make a great TV mini-drama of some kind. There's all the elements here. But I'll read it to you. It's in Kings, 1 Kings chapter 21. Got to get my Naboth voice on. Later, the following events took place. Naboth the Jezreelite, had a vineyard in Jezreel, beside the palace of King Ahab of Samaria. And Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard, so that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near my house. I will give you a better vineyard for it, or if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money." But Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance." Ahab went home resentful and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him. For he had said, "I will not give you my ancestral inheritance." He lay down on his bed, turned away his face, and would not eat. His wife Jezebel came to him and said, "Why are you so depressed that you will not eat?" He said to her, "Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, 'Give me your vineyard for money, or else if you prefer, I'll give you another vineyard for it.' But he answered, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" His wife Jezebel said to him, "Do you now govern Israel? Get up, eat some food and be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters to Ahab's in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. She sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who lived with Naboth in his city. She wrote in the letters, "Proclaim a fast and seat Naboth at the head of the assembly. Seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them bring a charge against him, saying, 'You've cursed God and the king.' Then take him out and stone him to death." The men of his city, the elders and the nobles who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, just as it was written in the letters that she had sent to them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth at the head of the assembly. The two scoundrels came in and sat opposite him, and the scoundrels brought a charge against him, against Naboth, in the presence of the people, saying, "Naboth cursed God and the king." So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, "Naboth has been stoned. He's dead." As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Go take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive but dead." As soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab set out to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, the Tishbite, saying, go down to meet King Ahab of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He is now in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to take possession. You shall say to him, thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession? You shall say to him, thus says the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, dogs will also lick up your blood. You need to read the rest of the story and see what happens with what the prophet says. This all takes place in a the vineyard is in Jezreel. Jezreel's not just any place. It's up on a kind of highland and overlooks the coastal plain of Israel. And it was a strategic town. And it was a place where the king had his chariot teams all settled down. It was a military fortification. It was a very strategic place. Often the historic battles that happened in Israel took place on the plain just underneath Jezreel. So this isn't just any place. This is an important political, strategic place. We know a lot about King Ahab. He was part of a new dynasty of the clan of Omri. It was a dynasty that after this event would only last for a couple more kings, or a king and a half after Ahab. But we know nothing about Naboth. We only know this story about him. Like so many of the ordinary folks in history, we usually only hear their story when they come in contact with the powerful and the important. So I want you to think about what happens in this story as it unfolds. Before the prophet arrives, what's the bits of the story as it happens? What happens first? Any ideas? You have to help me. What happens first in the story? King wants Naboth's vineyard. Naboth says no. King then? No, he makes an offer. Doesn't he? He says, I'll give you a better vineyard, or I'll give you money, lots of money. Just let me have your vineyard. And Naboth says, no. Why does he say no? It's a trust. It's mine. It's an inheritance. I can't give it to you. I'm just kind of caretaker sort of guy. It's got to go on to my descendants. And then what happens? Naboth chucks a tantrum, and it's a good one, isn't he? He goes home, doesn't eat anything. He says it very descriptive. He rolls over and faces the wall. This is a big wobbly that Naboth is putting on here. And who should turn up? Jezebel, his wife. And what's she say? What sort of king are you throwing a wobbly? Aren't you king? For goodness sake. And then what she says? She's telling him to get up and go and get Naboth, or what? I'll do it for you. She's a very good kind of queen, isn't she? She's going to take care of business. And then what happens? Yes, exactly. No! Wrong. What happens then? What happens then after Jezebel says she's going to take care of it? Yes, but it's a bit more intricate plot than that. You wouldn't like that teledrama if it just went and she just killed Naboth. She's got to organize, do a bit of organizing. What'd she do? She writes letters to the local politicians in the area, the elite. And she gets in touch with a couple of local thugs and says, this is the plan. We throw a fast. Like, why would you be at the head of a table at a fast? That's a bit odd, isn't it? It's really about the feast that comes at the end of the fast. So I put him at the head of the table, then make false accusations against him. And then what? Go out and stone him. And then as soon as he's stoned and dead, what happens then? And turns it into a lovely garden. No. What happens then? What happens when he's stoned and dead? Huh? No, I'm trying to... They're all going to sleep in the back row. They must have had a very busy day. What happens when he's been put to death? Sorry? He goes down to the to take possession. And then the prophet turns up with an unkind word for Ahab. And it's a very unkind word, isn't it? So that's the plot. How do you feel about this story? Does it make you happy? Does it make you sad? Sad? Angry? Who said angry? James? Was it James was the angry one? Oh, you, Phoebe, was the angry one. Any other feelings out there? It's an injustice, yes? Disgusted? How does it make you feel? It's a bit petty. It's a bit petty, isn't it? Yeah. 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 Yep. Yep. It makes me think if I was in Naboth's shoes, I would just be utterly powerless to do anything. I've got this king against me, but more than that, I've got his ruthless wife, and I'm... Who am I? I'm just poor Naboth the farmer. What can I do to... Yeah, surprising. Well, we'll get on to that because the accusation about Naboth is really... He never did. It's the opposite of the truth. It's the complete opposite of the truth. So who are the characters in this story? Just let's name them. Naboth... Ahab, who's the king? Jezebel. The scoundrels. The elders, the local political elite. The scoundrels, the literal translation is the sons of worthlessness. And the town dogs who do the licking up and the prophet who rocks up at the time. So there's all these different characters in the story. Let's just try and work out what they might have thought about different things. What might have Naboth thought about the land and about the power of a king? What do you reckon Naboth thought about the land? No. He said no to the king. He thought he had a right to say no to the king. Yes, he thought he was standing on solid legal ground, if you like. Yes. What did he think about the land? Was important to him? Sorry? It was in trust. It's almost like our indigenous people, you know, we don't own the land, we belong to the land. And in, you know, when God made, Matt talked about Genesis last time, but there's a word play in that passage about when God made Adam. Because Adam, the name Adam comes from Adama. Adama means the earth. So Adam comes from Adama. So it's kind of a poetic play on words when in the creation story. But that's really the understanding Naboth would have had. I'm from the land. The land belongs, I belong to the land as much as the land belongs to me. And it's not mine, it's for my descendants. And you know, in the Jewish tradition or law, the land was the gift from God. And the land was to be taken care of. And every seventh day, you would have a rest, or the first day of the week, every seventh day you'd have a rest. Every seventh year, the land would have a rest. Every 50 years, the land, if it had got gone into debt to someone or been taken by someone else would go back to its original owner. So there was this idea it never could never be alienated permanently from the people who God had gifted it to. So that was Naboth. Naboth thought he had rights. He thought of the land as not his. He was a caretaker. What about Ahab? What did Ahab think about the land and about the rights of a king? Did he really? He should have, but he didn't take it. He threw a wobbly. He recognized Naboth's rights, didn't he? Yes. Yeah. He understood Naboth. There was kind of an agreement. They operated in the same kind of universe. He understood how Naboth understood the land, even though he wanted to use it as a commodity. He understood the tradition that Naboth was coming out of. And he understood the limit of kingship, that you can't go around exploiting your people. You have power, but it's on trust to them. That's why he threw a wobbly. What about Jezebel? She didn't have a clue, did she? She said, you're a king. You just go and take the blinding thing. You don't mess around with negotiating or just go and take it if it's yours. And you're such a wimp, you can't do it. I'll just do it for you. Do we know anything about Jezebel? Who was this Jezebel? She's a bit famous because people even today in our world talk about don't be a Jezebel. Who was she? She was a foreigner. She was a Phoenician. She was from a different religious community that lived along the coast. They were coastal traders. And for power reasons, King Ahab had married her to make an alliance. So she comes out of a different understanding altogether. The Phoenicians had this religion. They worshipped a god called Baal. And Ahab gave her permission to go and set up all these worship places all through Israel and also to keep a whole lot of priests of Baal to support them and keep them engaged and, you know, fed and all that sort of stuff. So Ahab basically remained silent as Jezebel went and did all that. And that becomes one of the focus of the prophets. They become really angry that this religion of Baal has been able to spread through Israel. So what was her understanding of the land, Jezebel? It's like anything else. It's a commodity. You want it, you take it. There's no attachment to anything. It's just like, if you want it, you get it. It's a thing. It's a simple thing. What about the rights of a king or the rights of Naboth? How did Jezebel understand that? If you're a king, you're the most powerful, you just take whatever you want. There were some other characters. Jezebel writes off this letter to the elders. It's kind of like the local elite, the leading families in the area. How do you reckon they understood the king, the rights of the king and the... Yeah, why would they do that? Huh? Could be fear. More likely to be patronage. Like, if I put myself in debt to the king and do something he wants, then he'll help me when the time comes. So they understood the king as a patron. You've got to get on the good side of this guy, no matter what, because it'll do me good in the future. Then there were these other two guys that talked about in the scoundrels, the sons of worthlessness. What do you reckon they were thought about the king, thought about the land? Probably didn't care about the land. They didn't know about it. They probably didn't know about it, yeah. What did they think about the king or anything? Money, money, money. You pay me, I'll do it. As long as I've got a bit of money to have a drink tonight, have fun with my mates, whatever. That was what it was about. So we see already in this story that these different views of power. There's different views of rights. There's different views of the limitations of what you can do to another person. And the prophet comes in and really says, well, God's got an opinion of all of this. And Ahab is responsible for all of this. Do you think Ahab should be responsible for all this? Wasn't it Jezebel's fault? He did. He was silent. He just stood by. Jezebel says, well, I'll go and fix it all up. And Ahab doesn't say anything. Yep. Why wasn't he? So in his silence, he's just complicit. Does that happen in our world where the powerful just don't tell me? Go fix it. Don't tell me. I don't want to know what happens, how it's done, because I don't want to be implicated in any of this. Does it sound a bit like familiar to our modern... Well, I can think of examples closer to home than that. But yes, it's a strategy of power. He's responsible, so it's him that God is judging. He could have said no. Ahab is created. Naboth is a child of God, demands respect. The land is the gift from God, but he fails to do it. In the end, that story, when you read it through, Ahab says, no, don't wipe out my family and everything like that. And God says, oh, okay, not now, but there's going to have to be a time when this dynasty comes to an end. Because there is a tendency, isn't it, even within our own world, where corrupt power seems to go on intergenerationally and embed itself and institutionalize itself. And God says, no, this dynasty of kings is no longer got my blessing. It's going to come to an end. I want Jesse to show us a video, the long one. It's about human rights and where they might have come from.
Human rights is... Geez, that's a good question.
Human rights. Well, that's a tough one.
Wow.
I don't even know how to give that a definition.
I would probably have to do a little bit of homework or something.
Any right that I think any, just as a normal, you know, human, any...
The rights that humans have.
Oh, that's a very large debate.
We just take them for granted that they're there, but we don't even consider what they are.
Human rights are the rights you have simply because you're human. It's how you instinctively expect and deserve to be treated as a person, like the right to live freely, to speak your mind, and to be treated as an equal. There are many kinds of rights. Most apply to a certain group. But human rights are the only ones that apply to absolutely everyone, everywhere. That means kids, old people, poor people, basketball players, garbage men, rappers, teachers, Africans, Indians, Albanians, Christians, Muslims, Kabbalists, atheists, your mom, your dad, your next door neighbor, and you all have the exact same human rights. In other words, they're universal. But the question remains, what are they?
Name the human rights?
What the human rights are?
The right to live.
Equality between all peoples.
Right to religion, the right to...
Is there supposed to be a list somewhere I should be aware of?
According to the United Nations, there are a total of 30 human rights, which are usually lumped together and called simply human rights. They're all listed out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the world's most widely accepted document on the subject. But it was a long time in coming. At first, there were no human rights. If you were in with the right crowd, you were safe. If you weren't, well, you weren't. But then a guy named Cyrus the Great decided to change all that. After conquering Babylon, he did something completely revolutionary. He announced that all slaves, were free to go. He also said people had the freedom to choose their religion, no matter what crowd they were a part of. He documented his words on a clay tablet known as the Cyrus Cylinder. And just like that, human rights were born. The idea spread quickly to Greece, to India, and eventually to Rome. They noticed that people naturally followed certain laws, even if they weren't told to. They called this natural law, but it kept getting trampled on by those in power. Not until 1,000 years later in England did they finally get a king to agree that no one can overrule the rights of the people, not even a king. People's rights were finally recognized, and they were now safe from those in power. Kind of. It still took a bunch of British rebels declaring their independence before the king got the point that all men are created equal. Which isn't to say he liked the idea, but he couldn't stop them, and America was born. The French immediately followed with their own revolution for their own rights. Their list was even longer, and they insisted that these rights weren't just made up. They were natural. The Roman concept of natural law had become natural rights. Unfortunately, not everyone was so thrilled. In France, a general named Napoleon decided to overthrow the new French democracy and crown himself emperor of the world. He almost succeeded. But the countries of Europe joined forces and defeated him. Human rights was again a hot topic. They drew up international agreements, broadly granting many rights across Europe. But only across Europe. The rest of the world somehow still didn't qualify. Instead, they got invaded, conquered, and consumed by Europe's massive empires. But then a young lawyer from India decided enough was enough. His name was Mahatma Gandhi, and in the face of violence, he insisted that all people of Earth had rights, not just in Europe. Eventually, even Europeans started to agree. But it wasn't going to be that easy. Two world wars erupted. Hitler exterminated half the Jewish population of Earth in horrifying Nazi death camps. And all told, 90 million people died. Never had human rights been so terrifyingly close to extinction. And never had the world been more desperate for change. So the countries of Earth banded together and formed the United Nations. Their basic purpose was to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person. But what were human rights? Were they the proclamations of Cyrus? The natural laws of Rome? The declarations of France? Everyone seemed to have a slightly different idea of what human rights should be. But under the supervision of Eleanor Roosevelt, they finally agreed on a set of rights that apply to absolutely everyone. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The French concept of natural rights had finally become human rights. So, in summary, at first, only a few lucky people had any rights. Until one of those guys decided, hey, other people should have some rights too. Which was great, except not everyone agreed. And it only took a few thousand years of fighting and declarations and more fighting until everyone finally agreed that human rights should apply to everyone. And they all lived happily ever after. Except for one little problem. If people have the right to food and shelter, why are 16,000 children dying of starvation every day? One every 5 seconds. If people have freedom of speech, why are thousands in prison for speaking their minds? If people have the right to education, why are over 1 billion adults unable to read? If slavery has truly been abolished, why are 27 million people still enslaved today? More than twice as many as in 1800. The fact is, when it was signed, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights did not have the force of law. It was optional. And despite many more documents, conventions, treaties, and laws, it's still little more than words on a page. So the question is, who will make those words a reality?
I have a dream today.
When Dr. King marched for racial equality, He was marching for rights that had been guaranteed by the United Nations for almost 2 decades. But still, he marched. When Nelson Mandela stood up for social justice in the 1990s, his country had already agreed to abolish such discrimination for almost 40 years. But still, he fought. Those who fight today against torture, poverty, and discrimination are not giants or superheroes. They're people. Kids, mothers, fathers, teachers, free-thinking individuals who refuse to be silent, who realize that human rights are not a history lesson. They're not words on a page. They're not speeches or commercials or PR campaigns. They are the choices we make every day as human beings. They are the responsibility we all share to respect each other, to help each other, and to protect those in need. As Eleanor Roosevelt said, where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places close to home. So close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Yet they are the world of the individual person, the neighborhood he lives in, the school or college he attends, the factory, farm, or office where he works. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere.
I think that's a very good and short narrative of where human rights come from. I think they leave out a little the impact of the Jewish tradition and the Christian churches in when they were formulating the Declaration of Universal Human Rights. The churches were very much a part of that. They were represented there at the table. They were very much influential. And drawing on those traditions that come through our Jewish Christian traditions. What the human rights represent is what King Ahab and Naboth had before Jezebel rocked up. It was a consensus about the worth of a human being and the limitations of the power of the powerful. Jezebel really comes in and she says, this consensus is off the table. Those with power have no limit on what they can do to those without power. What human rights in the modern world tries to do is to create that kind of consensus again. Human rights aren't Christian, but they can be affirmed by Christian because they're coherent with our tradition and faith. Human rights aren't Buddhist, but they can be affirmed by Buddhists because they can find the roots of that kind of consensus and the valuing of human beings in their traditions. They're not values of non-believers or atheists, but they can be affirmed because people can find those values in their own traditions. You know, as Christians, we can go around and say, well, this is what we believe in. We can assert our beliefs about how the world should run. But what the world desperately needs is not the assertions of particular groups, but a consensus about how human life must be valued and how power should be limited. And that's really what human rights give us. As Christians, they go back to what Matt was talking about before, that every one of us is created in the image of God. I like to think of that as if we're in the image of God, see, this is the image of God here. Maybe it's like a picture or something like that, a painting. And I throw it on the ground, and then I get my feet and I stomp all over it and I twist it and destroy it. And what I do to that human being, I'm doing to the very image of God. And for us as Christians, that's foundational to how we understand human rights. In my work in the Philippines, but even in Australia, so often I saw people who were just, they were killed, they had their land taken away, they had their possessions seized, and they were totally powerless to do anything about it because it was done by the police, the military, the people in authority. Their human rights were totally ignored. And there's an obligation on the rest of us whose human rights haven't yet been ignored to stand up and say, that's wrong. This can't be done. You can't just arbitrarily kill someone. You can't arbitrarily take someone's possessions away or seize them their land and take it away from them. You can't do that, and I'm not going to be someone that will keep quiet when that's done. The reality is, if we don't speak up for the weakest when they get their land taken away, their life seized, when they're denied of access to education or discriminated against, if we don't say anything when it happens to the weakest, there'll be no one to say anything when it comes and happens to us. We act out of love, but in acting out of love, we're really acting out of love as well for ourselves and the defence of our own rights.